The Great Lakes are one of the world's largest surface freshwater ecosystems, containing about 20% of the world's supply of surface freshwater. That's a point of interest that many Michigan residents know. But we also hear about the threats to Michigan water. Lead in Flint, PFAS chemicals everywhere. Helping water recover is a big issue for scientists, environmentalists, farmers, and anyone who uses Michigan's water. Unfortunately, our love of water contributes to the problem.
Where do we like to live? We like to live on the water, right? So much of our development has taken place in the coastal wetland.
If we harm the wetlands, we harm the water. Just ahead, we revisit our Third Coast conversation in Mount Pleasant, exploring recovery and resiliency of Michigan water. First, the news.
Financial support for WCMU's Third Coast Conversations comes from Michigan Humanities and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Learn more at MichiganHumanities.org.
Welcome back. I'm Amy Robinson. Water goes through a lot. I mean, we know it's necessary for life, and people say they value it. Some even take jobs to protect it. But those three atoms, they get a workout as groundwater, surface water, wastewater. And when we talk about recovery and resiliency of water, like we did at our Third Coast Community Conversation in Mount Pleasant, a lot of issues come up. We're going to cover some of them tonight. We start out by hearing from one of our experts, Judy Pamp, with the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe. She says Native Americans see water as having a spirit.
We know that water is life. In order for there to be any life form, there has to be water. But if you take it even a step further, in our belief systems, we are spiritual beings having this physical life, and water is a spiritual entity. So it is a life of its own and a life force. And so our goal is that with everything in creation, how do we take and interact, help meet our needs, but yet not impact the other life forms there and have that way of honoring them. And so that's our ultimate goal. So when we are asked to make decisions, we're oftentimes say to really think it through and ask ourselves, how's this going to impact our own selves, our families, our communities? How's this going to impact the animals? How's this going to impact the soil, the earth, Mother Earth? How's this going to impact the waterways, the airways, you know, the insects, you know, the birds? How's this going to impact them? Because we are told to always be thinking seven generations, that if we only think right here and now, we're not going to take care of others. So we need to be very mindful and think in a deeper level of how do we care for that waterway, for our needs, for our grandchildren's needs, our great-grandchildren's needs, but also the needs of all creation.
So looking at when we talk about resiliency and recovery of waterways, and with the long, deep history that the Anishinaabe people have, what is the state of our water today?
It's sick. I'll put it in simple terms. It's ill. It really is. It's ill. And if it's ill, we're ill. We really are. We're getting sick with it. And so then the real question is then, what do we have to do to help it recover? Because just like humans, we can get sick, then what do we need to do to better our health? That's what we're asking. What do we need to do to better the health of water? And we're taught in our communities, it's actually our women, we have the responsibility of overseeing the care of the water. That's one of our responsibilities as being Anishinaabe. And so we are taught prayers to say to the water. We are taught songs to sing over the water. And then part of our life path has to be educating others, not only the importance of the water, but how do we care for it.
Are you able to share one of the prayers or songs with us?
I can. So I have a copy here. I'll send it around for you to look at later, but I can sing it. I'm hoping my voice, I've just got done doing tours for about 3 hours, so we'll see how my voice is. It looks like a piece of cloth, but when we say our prayers, and we say them with Sema, our tobacco. So we use tobacco and we lay it down right on the water for those prayers for the water. and the songs for the water. So we would sprinkle some of that tobacco on the edge of the water. And so the song that I'll sing for you, it literally says, water, we love you. We are thankful for the water, and then we will care for the water. Nibish gizakego chimikwach nuwe emigo kishawe nemigo Nibish gizakego chimikwach nuwe emigo kishawe nemigo Nibish gizakego chimikwach nuwe emigo kishawe nemigo. You would sing that through four times, and as you do that, as part of our water ceremonies, we would have a copper vessel with water, you know, probably from that river, from that pond, and then we would take and through each of the directions raise that water and sing to the Creator to take care of that water, and then also showing that water that respectful way that we're here also trying to oversee your care, and because it is that spiritual entity, that's part of the care is also caring for not only the physical sense of water, but that spiritual sense of water too.
I want to talk about that a little more. So we're going to talk to Don in a minute, and he has data. He's our data guy, and he digs into researching and quantifying and calculating and finding out all these really important things, mainly on wetlands, which are so important. Mm-hmm. And now you talk about the spiritual part of water. How do you see the two working together? It sounds like you're saying, no, we can't just adjust chemicals and do the scientific things, that there's this other piece to it.
Right. It's kind of a holistic way of caring for things in life. So I think it's just bringing both knowledge together so that you can really help with the quality of the life of water. I mean, we are so blessed here in the Great Lakes that sometimes we can take and overlook how blessed we are to have so much fresh water. But this blessing is here for all of creation, and someday it might be the only fresh water that's for the whole world. I mean, I never thought in my lifetime I would see tragedies like Flint and the poisoning of their waterway. And I had our sister city here in Mount Pleasant is Ukiah. I went to Ukiah in 2014 and was asked, could I do a ceremony? And I says, well, that's a broad term. You know, could you kind of give me some more guidance on what you're looking for? And the more we talked, I said, why don't we do something around water? Because you guys being an island and us being a peninsula and that blessing of water. So we decided I would do a water ceremony. Unannounced to me, they had a dead lake. They are at the base of mountains. And so they had, Lake Seward was a dead lake. And the first thing in my mouth is, how did you kill it? Oh my gosh, you know, I tried hard not to cry because, you know, there was a lot of people there for the ceremony. I said, but how do you kill it? This is a living thing, what happened? And they for thousands of years had done silk industry and didn't know the full impact. Then how do you reverse that? That's what we're really talking about. How do we reverse the impact of man? And so then I told him, I says, you know, it took me about 6 months to really figure out what to bring to you guys. And I think the Creator said that, you know, we really need to bring this here and talk about the spiritual essence of water and how you have to also spiritually cleanse it as well as the physical cleansing. And they had not thought of that. So they had arranged later, some of their monks and that, to meet with me so they could continue in their own teachings how to continue to take care of that spiritual essence. And so I think that we can do the same relationship here.
This conversation had an interesting way of merging spirituality with science. Our other expert was from academia. Don Uzarski is professor of biology at Central Michigan University. He serves as the director of CMU's Institute for Great Lakes Research and Biological Station on Beaver Island. He's an aquatic ecologist with a focus on measures of ecosystem health of Great Lakes coastal wetlands. Don leads a 10-year, $20 million Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program for the U.S. EPA. When we talk about ways humans impact water, he gets it.
Much of our development, our human development around the Great Lakes, where do we like to live? We like to live on the water, right? So much of our development has taken place in the coastal wetland, right? It should be upland where we should build, then coastal wetland, then open water of the Great Lakes. But we want to live right on the shore. So resorts, houses, roads were built historically on the coastal wetlands. Well, coastal wetlands migrate. When the water levels of the Great Lakes go down, the coastal wetland follows it, follows the shoreline, moves towards the open water. When water levels come up, the wetland moves upland. And that actually creates these more diverse, larger wetlands, because you could think of that as stretching that system out. Well, with the prolonged lows that we saw, the wetlands were recovering lakeward of resorts that historically had seawalls and then a small beach, or houses or roads that were built on the historic coastal wetland. So restoration was taking place sort of on its own. The system was recovering it. You could think of that wetland migrating out from underneath that house or that road or that resort and popping up where it should be following the water levels. Obviously, if you're a homeowner and you're used to living on a beach and you're making a living with that beach, that might not be something you're too fond of. So when we see prolonged lows in water levels, we tend to see more dredging, more human disturbance on the ecosystem. And in many cases, there was farm equipment taken out, tilling under the coastal wetlands that were popping up. High water levels spark human disturbance as well. What happens when the water level comes up? We build seawalls, right? We as homeowners and users, we don't like change, right? But these systems are supposed to change and supposed to fluctuate. So when we start seeing these large alterations in hydrology changing the ecosystem, our response is generally to fight that.
And we just have a minute left, but let me ask you the big question. From where you sit, what is the state of our water?
That can't be answered in 1 minute. It depends. It's not wonderful. I mean, there are the Great Lakes in particular, we have 180 exotic species, and we get a new one on average every 8 months. That's really altering the food web. But when we think of pollutants and toxicants, at least if we go back, if we compare today with the pre-Clean Water Act of 1972, we're in much better shape with respect to water quality overall. But keep in mind, we have 43 areas of concern across the Great Lakes Basin, U.S. and Canada, where you can't drink the water, there are beneficial use impairments, you can't swim in the water, you can't eat the fish. So we certainly still have our problems. We have our new problems popping up that we try to understand as quickly as they pop up. But my response, I find myself talking about water quality and ecosystems and aquatic ecosystems, and I hear myself sounding extremely negative. But then I like to remind people, you know, rivers aren't catching on fire anymore, and they were. Pre-Clean Water Act. So there are bright sides.
But getting buy-in on efforts to help water recover is not always easy. Even people who see it every day sometimes don't do the right thing.
Everyone loves water. Everyone loves to look at water. People spend thousands of dollars to dig a pond in their backyard just so they can look at a flat surface of water with a couple ducks sitting on it. There's a disconnect between the way we love water and the way we treat water. You know, I participate in the Cooperative Lakes Monitor Program, which is a bunch of individual citizens coordinated through the Michigan Clean Water Initiative. And I monitor Coldwater Lake for clarity and take water samples and probably much less scientific than what Don does, but we take samples of the lake to just track progress. You know, is the lake okay? So there's a network of a lot of folks out there who are very concerned about water. But a lot of folks, you know, they love the water, they want to buy a house at the lake, so they want their house at the lake to look like their house in town. So they buy a place at the lake, they want the lawn to go all the way down to the water's edge, which leads to erosion because there's no root system, which leads to runoff, and then they have to build a seawall, which leads to, you know, it's a vicious cycle. So somewhere there's a disconnect in the way we love water and the way we treat water.
In Elma, we had a big meeting, Healthy Pine River group put on a meeting about the water quality of the Pine River. And at that point, the city of Elma was actually using the Pine River for 10, 15, 20% of its drinking water, right? I heard people in this meeting said they were talking about the science of it, the E. coli, the coliform bacteria, antibiotic resistance, so on. And people in the meeting, citizens, said, well, I don't live on the pine. What do I care? Well, that's a disconnect there. Like, you're still drinking the water, right, if you're in town, even if you can't see the water. So, yeah, they seem disinterested at that point. Well, I can't see it. Well, I don't care about it. But the people that lived on the pine see the results of some of the stuff, and the people that were connected to that group see the science and hear about it. And so, obviously, they're a little bit more vested, it seems.
Right.
So maybe there's an educational value. Back to your point.
And our conversation participants spent a fair amount of time talking about how to live on the water without damaging the water. One message, if you have lake, don't work so hard to grow a lawn.
I would like to ask, in Coldwater Lake, how do you solve the problem of the landowners mowing right down to the edge? How do you educate them to explain that they have to have a filter strip?
Well, I'm trying. I'm involved in the Coldwater Lake Association, the environmental director, and also an officer. So I manage most of the semi-annual meetings. And over the past several years, I always get on my soapbox about fertilizers, keep the fertilizers away from the lake. And then the last 4 or 5 years, we have replanted some of our lawn that was there when we bought the house. Back to some natural lakeshore. So I'm trying, and so what we try to do is we're trying to get our residents to consider that the lake is a living thing, and that it's a good idea if you have 100 feet of lake frontage, you don't need 100 feet of lawn going all the way down to the lake. You can plant some nice plants, it looks nice, and put a little bench there and a little walkway, and it can look very nice. And so little by little, trying to get folks who live on the lake, at least our lake, to reconsider the way they look at the lake and the way they look at their lawns. I like to tell them, at every lake association meeting, I like to say, you know, I've seen a lot of tombstones. And one thing I've never seen written on a tombstone is, he had a perfect lawn.
And do you use your lawn, your yard, as a demonstration project? Do people get to see? Because everybody thinks that they have to have a nice clean lawn and
right.
No, nothing untidy.
Yes.
And you have to change the attitude that the untidiness is good.
Yes. We have one lake shore. We have the lake shore along Littlefield Road on the east. There's a lot of cedar trees and a lot of rocks and not a lot of lawns down to the lake. And then on the west, it's a lot of lawns and seawalls and houses. And so last meeting, I said, you know, when you take a ride out on the lake, do you want to look at trees or do you want to look at vinyl siding? You know, what do you want to look at? So I do kind of put that out. I don't try to make an example. Go look at our house because we planted all this stuff because it's my plantation, and it looks a little rough. So far, it's really just a bunch of wild flower seeds, and I don't mow the lawn half of our front yard. But I do try. But I get literature from the Michigan Lake Stewardship Association and try to give them information about the natural lake shore.
It's not just lawns that damage lakes. Sometimes it's what's under the lawn. If private septic tanks aren't maintained, and many aren't, they can cause all kinds of problems for Michigan water. You're listening to Third Coast Conversation, Mount Pleasant, Recovery and Resiliency of Waterways, a production of WCMU Public Radio. This project is made possible by a grant from Michigan Humanities, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The program continues in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Amy Robinson. Tonight we're following up to a Third Coast community conversation held in Mount Pleasant. The conversation was made possible by a grant from Michigan Humanities with the National Endowment for the Humanities. The focus was on recovery and resiliency of Michigan's waterways. So when participants considered how to protect the water, the conversation swung to two things: agricultural runoff, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, and septic tanks.
I work with the environmental team on the tribe, and this water is sick. It's very sick, and we've sampled this water in this local community, and there is repeated levels of E. coli throughout the entire summer. And, you know, no, I won't let my grandchildren play in this water close to this community, but that's sad for me because I've played in this water my whole life. So something really does have to be done.
Tell us your ideas based on the sampling that you've done with respect to the causes of the, I presume you're talking about bacterial runoffs and E. coli coliforms in, that you're sampling. The thought had been that it was animal caused from so much agricultural use of manures that would run off the land. But now we know that there's a pretty big human septic system source as well, at least coming into the North Branch and then into the main Chippewa Branch. Can you tell us any more updated information on sourcing?
Well, the E. coli levels that are collected are posted through the county. I'm sure there's a source through the tribe that you can get them as well throughout the summer. And those fluctuations do change with rainfalls. And frequently, I wouldn't say, you know, I wouldn't say that I have a professional, you know, means of giving information, but there is definitely contribution to those E. coli levels from the sources that you've stated. As far as progress being made, you know, it's like trying to catch the wind. You know, you have farmers who have to make a living, and they can't control all of the weather. They can't control how much rain we're going to get. The things that they can control are their waste product from their farms and whatnot. But it's going to find its way into the river. That's inevitable. Many of the septic systems that are located in this area are very antiquated. So how do you pick and choose which system is going to be updated? How are you going to support that change? Who can afford it? You know, if there are people that only use these homes seasonally, they're not going to invest money to completely overhaul their septic system. And there are entire communities that didn't have up-to-code septic systems. So, I mean, how would you make that change immediately? So that's an unfortunate circumstance, but it's something that will eventually have to be addressed for these levels to change.
Don, do you know, are you aware of anybody who's, any communities that are doing that? I mean, we have Superfund sites, even one, of course, down in Alma, and one here too. But it's going to take maybe more than local money in order to revamp entire communities' non-performing septic systems because individuals can't afford it in some cases. And it's in the millions. Your $10 million wouldn't have even solved this one problem.
No, and especially the rural communities that that we're mainly talking about are not seeing the funding going for infrastructure for them. Awareness at this point, and at least we are addressing some communities, and they tend to be the inner cities.
Charlie.
I can shed a little bit light on your question, Roger, a little bit of something that is being done. One of the communities out by where I live on Coldwater Lake, and when the tribe did the testing, the E. coli, they found that the Beale City area was a big source of that. Well, the Beale City now is in the process of installing a sewer system, okay, because they haven't had proper sewage there. So Beale City is the target date for completion is sometime 2021, and it's a long process, but the funding is there, and all the vote, you know, everything is done, but the signing of the papers and dotting the I's and getting the funding from rural development. But Beale City is getting a sewer system, and now they ask Coldwater Lake, where I live, if the lake residents would like to join in, and overwhelmingly the response was yes. So now Coldwater Lake is getting a sewer system, which is just fabulous, because, you know, we have all these old septic systems on the lake. So that's going to be that's going to have a huge impact on the quality of our water.
People are looking for ways to mitigate their impact, and a public sewage system in a tiny community may be one of the success stories. We sent Sarah Bikes to Beale City to learn about the community and the watershed.
Beale City is an unincorporated part of Isabella County. It has a population of 350 people. It only has around 130 homes in the city. This little town doesn't even qualify as a municipality, but it is getting a new municipal sewage system. Currently, Beale City uses on-site septic systems to take care of wastewater. On-site septic systems treat small levels of wastewater from a home or business. It operates independently of a public system. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, on-site septic tanks are better options for keeping surface and groundwater free of contaminants, if they are maintained. And it seems that's a big if. Molly Ripke is a biologist with the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, or EGLE. She says if septic systems are not maintained, they can cause problems with the home's water supply and the local water supply.
Raw sewage is in septic systems. So if the septic systems aren't treating the waste properly, then you can have things like that happen where the septic systems are contaminating surface water, or they're leaching into storm sewers and then discharging to surface water.
Officials in Beale City say the use of on-site septic tanks increase contamination in the nearby Wagner Drain. The drain flows into the north branch of the Chippewa River. Pete Lorenz is an engineer with the new public sewer system project. He says the project was started because of elevated levels of E. coli found 3 years ago.
There was some testing that was done by the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe in the Wagner Drain, which did have some elevated levels. It then prompted the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, also did some of their own independent testing, which also indicated some elevated levels, which prompted the project.
Back in 2016, the then Michigan Department of Environmental Quality found two areas, both on the Wagner Drain on Beale City Road, that exceeded allowable E. coli levels. Two were of specific concern. Researchers found one area north of Beale City Road was 3 times higher than the state maximum limit. The other area south of Beale City Road contained E. coli more than 10 times above the state limit. Molly Repke with EGLE was one of the researchers that sampled the water. She says high levels of E. coli increase the risk for disease.
The water quality standard was being exceeded downstream of the town. So therefore, if people are contacting it, then they would be at an elevated risk for illness.
The EGLE report says that the levels found were, quote, an unacceptable risk to public health. Officials say the high levels of E. coli increase the risks of waterborne disease transmission. They also say the contaminants found in Wagner Drain are likely to be present downstream throughout the Chippewa River. The big question became, how did raw sewage get in the stream in the first place? According to the EGLE report, the source of the contamination was nearby homes. The report says inspectors found septic pipes discharging directly into the stream. Ripke says septic tanks that work properly rely on natural processes to filter out contaminants, but in places like Beale City, they couldn't do their job.
Septic tanks in themselves do not treat sewage completely. So if you have a septic tank and it's not connected to an absorption field that works, then you're not treating the sewage and you're not putting it where it belongs.
The EGLE report said a majority of homes in Beale City didn't have a septic permit and didn't fit the requirements for on-site septic tanks. Even today, Loren says most of the homes in Beale City are a bad fit for on-site septic systems.
Well, some of the lots are small, and the soils, they're heavier clay soils, so they don't allow for infiltration as well. So there's some space issues as far as the size of the lots go, and then the soil conditions both make it difficult for on-site septic systems to work properly.
The improper septic tanks then led to a violation from Eagle. The notice said, quote, "The violations in Beale City have been occurring for many years and are ongoing. Since Beale City is an unincorporated community, the blame fell on Nottawa Township to clean up the mess. Eagle and Nottawa Township had a meeting and determined the township had to take corrective action. Loren says the township is mandated by Eagle to create a public sewer system that will manage Beale City's wastewater.
Currently in the process of designing the system for the collection system in Beale City and a force main, which is a sewer main that will run to the City of Mount Pleasant wastewater treatment plant for treatment of the sewage. We're in the design phase right now.
Nottawa Township is required by the state to fix the Beale City sewer, but the township decided to expand the new sewer system to the nearby Coldwater Lake area after residents there expressed an interest in being added to the project. Officials say the project will now cost around $9 million. The township is looking to get most of the money by applying for grant funding. They're hoping to limit residents' out-of-pocket costs.
We've made application to USDA Rural Development for funding, and we've secured the funding for Beale City.
Preliminary estimates found the public sewer project could cost Beale City residents between $12,000 and $16,000 per household that would be paid across a 40-year period. So far, the township has been able to secure $3 million from the state of Michigan and more than $2 million from the USDA for the project. Loren says the township won't have an exact cost for residents until the project design is complete.
But without having the design completed and without having bids in from the actual contractors on the system, the cost won't be known until, you know, we actually get the bids from the contractor.
Loren says whatever the final cost, the benefits will outweigh the upfront costs. He says the new sewer system will address the contamination issues in Beale City and will be a future asset to Nottawa Township.
Mandated by the state of Michigan, DEQ, for Beale City to correct this problem. There are various homes don't have room to do adequate systems on site. And then there are other homes that may have the area, but a lot of the soils aren't conducive to it. You know, Nottawa Township's in the position, and me personally are in the position of, I think this will be a great asset to the community.
Loren says this asset, a public septic system, will save Nottawa Township money in the long run.
You know, on-site septic systems can be expensive and costly to put in, and then you've got ongoing maintenance where you don't have that to deal with when you have a municipal sewer system. Now, it's my opinion. I think over time the community is going to see the good that's going to come from this, and it's, in the long run, I think it's going to be viewed as a positive, you know, for the area.
The township's new municipal sewer system will help ensure wastewater is properly treated. The new system will collect sewage from homes in Beale City and the Coldwater Lake area. The sewage will then travel to the Mount Pleasant Water Treatment Plant to be processed. Molly Ripke says having sewage sent to water treatment plants is the best solution for keeping water clean.
Wastewater treatment plants that chlorinate and properly treat their effluent are the ideal solution to sewage problems. Septic systems, essentially, you know, they're going to be putting the sewage slightly treated into the ground where it then percolates downward and gets further treatment. But, you know, there's no chlorine used in a septic system. The wastewater treatment plants are going to be disinfecting it either using chlorine or UV light. And so that is the ultimate treatment for sewage.
Ripke says other communities need to make sure their septic systems are working properly to keep sewage out of local rivers and streams. She says for places like Beale City, moving towards municipal water systems is the best option.
So if your septic system is located too close to a stream or is not functioning properly, then you may not get all the treatment that it really needs. It may end up finding its way into the surface water instead of percolating downward. And some people are in a situation where their homes, their building lots are too small to have the proper setback from a stream or the proper setback from their neighbor's home. So they just can't have a system that'll adequately treat it. So in cases like that, that's when sewers are the best option, if possible.
Under state requirements, Nottawa Township needs to have the new public sewer project completed by 2021. The township says they hope to have the system installed sooner. Sarah Bikes, WCMU News.
You're listening to follow-up from WCMU's Third Coast Community Conversation about the recovery and resiliency of water. This project was made possible by a grant from Michigan Humanities, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. When we return, we'll explore two more challenges to water quality, agriculture and industry. Welcome back. I'm Amy Robinson. Tonight we're talking about one of the most important elements in life, water. WCMU hosted a Third Coast Conversation about recovery and resiliency of water. The event was funded by a grant from Michigan Humanities with the National Endowment for the Humanities. 24 people turned out to talk about helping water survive. And one of the sources of contamination that was discussed was agriculture, fertilizers and chemicals, and our participants said, outdated regulations.
So you have the right to farm law, which hasn't been updated since 80s, early 80s maybe. You have clean water, clean area, all these things. You have septic ordinances, and you have, and I don't want to point fingers, but you have large organizations, and rightfully so, that are fighting for their members, because it's not cheap, right? So there has to be a balance. If we can't find a balance, it's going to be out of whack, one way or the other, and probably towards the negative. So,
I found it interesting that you brought up the Right to Farm Act. I'm also a farmer. I know that sounds conflicting. However, we have property on our farm that we have entered into the CRP program to where we have native grasses that are growing on there. And we have a lot of local farmers in our area who are surprisingly very ecologically aware, and they implement these programs on fields that they're not going to utilize. And so there are many fields and a lot of places that are not being used that are entered into these conservation programs. That in that program, you have to implement different things to filter water. We have a wetland on our property as well, and so we have planted accordingly to support filtrage into that water line. So I think that's something that is becoming more of a conscious effort within the agricultural community, and as well as now the big push for organic farming, we're also organic. Now people are realizing that if you want to supply your community with healthy food, it takes 3 years to become organic certified. So once you lose that, you lose it. And it's going to take you 3 years to get it back. And so separate from the farming legislature, a lot of, I'd say the smaller scale farms are really taking initiative to supply a healthier environment within the agricultural community.
I would agree. Thank you for pointing that out. I didn't mean to, like I said, point fingers. And so there's like meat certification as well that a lot of farmers I know are going through voluntarily. A lot of these are, and they're not cheap to do that stuff. So I full support of anybody who does that voluntarily. That's fantastic.
I think a big misconception about the farmers catch a lot of flack, you know. And I've got horses, I've raised some calves, I've got a bunch of friends that farm that I buy hay and stuff from. And it seems to me a lot of people think that these farmers are just dumping fertilizer, you know, hey, we got to get as much out of this property as we possibly can. And one thing people don't take into consideration is the cost of all those chemicals and stuff that the farmer does use to put on his property. A farmer's not making money by putting excess fertilizers and excess chemicals on his property. I mean, I don't know of a single farmer I know that says, you know, more is better, and they're just going full bore and dumping it up, you know, because it is going to just run off and be wasted, which to them impacts their bottom line. So, I don't know. It's just something I've noticed watching the news and stuff like that.
When I talk about water, I'm always talking about water quality in every class I teach, and I make it a point to say, you know, we talk about agricultural impacts on water quality, industrial impacts, but don't point the finger until you quit eating
or quit using industry. And at the same time, I've worked with the individual farmers, with industry. You're right. They don't want to pollute the water. We just have to learn to communicate better. We have to learn to communicate with the lawmakers, the scientists, general public, and these industries all working together to address those issues and just do it better.
And I think it's interesting, too, that the population keeps going up and up and up, and they want more and more production out of these fields, you know, to feed everybody. But we want cleaner water. And it's just, you know, it's, I don't know. I don't know all the numbers exactly, but it seems like you can only support so much. If you're going to keep building the population higher and higher and higher, something's got to give.
A lot of times it's economics. You know, we had a serious algae bloom on our lake last summer, and there's a big farm with a cattle operation and a hog operation directly upstream on our little river. They have just a little thin filter strip. They have the fields where they apply their manure are right there on the river. They come right into our lake, and we all of a sudden our lake turns green. And every time that happens, I sound the alarm. I will call the tribe first. I'll talk to Carrie, and then I'll call Julia Miller at the DEQ. Anyway, so I said I'm going to go up and very politely talk to these farmers. You know, so what am I getting into? So I went up and just talked to the lady who runs the office at the farm. And she and I said, do you know anything about this? Because our lake turned green. Oh no, we don't know. And she gave me the list of what we do. We have our tanks. We check our tanks every week. We have not applied since whatever the month was. And when we apply, we have 24 hours to work it in. And we do that. I was extremely impressed with the way they took care of things. But obviously, that's not always the case. When you look at the Gulf Coast of Florida, where you have the red tide, where you can't even go to the beach without coughing. Obviously, there's something there that's happening. And I think, you know, as a layperson, I think there are just some shortcuts. We can make more money. If we have 1,000 more cattle, we can make more money. And if we don't work in the manure into the soil, we can put our labor elsewhere. And I always say, well, I'd rather pay $2 a pound more for beefsteak than, you know, and figure out a way that we can raise the cattle and raise the hogs and do this and that without having everything run off. You know, take an extra step. I'll pay more for a loaf of bread.
You'll pay more, but what about the people who can't afford to pay more? That's the problem. You've got to consider them too, and there's a lot of those out there.
So we've talked about lawns, septic systems, and farmers. But there's one more issue that came up in our community conversation. Industry has also contributed to water quality problems. Steve Keene tells us about what could be the poster child for industrial contamination, the Velsicol chemical plant in St. Louis, Michigan. It contaminated the water, the wider environment, and humans. And experts say it may never be properly cleaned up.
We're taking a trip back to 1973. The setting is St. Louis, Michigan. It's a little town in Gratiot County that calls itself the middle of the mitten. I'm a college professor, Mary Borello, says during much of the 20th century, it was a renowned retreat.
St. Louis, Michigan was a destination spot. The Taylor Swifts of the day were coming to take a week or two and relax and be pampered and bathe in these mineral spots. And it was a gorgeous area. You know, the Pine River was a trout stream. It was beautiful.
And since 1973, St. Louis has caught the attention of people across the country, national reporters, and even top officials in the federal government. But not because of its spas. Instead, this little town, the middle of the mitten, became known for one of the worst environmental catastrophes in the country. It begins with Velsicol Chemical Corporation, which owned a large plant near the center of St. Louis.
The chemical plant made PBB, which was a fire retardant. And that was a white powder, and it was called Firemaster. And they also made a white powder called Nutrimaster, which was feed supplement to cattle. To some degree, they ran out of packaging bags for the fire retardant. And they either used bags that said Nutrimaster, and they crossed it out and wrote Firemaster, or they used bags that looked a lot like that. Suffice it to say, when the people came to pick up the cattle feed supplement, they really were picking up bags of fire retardant.
Borello says the mistake led to major consequences. PBB, the fire retardant, eventually wound up in commercial cattle feed and spread across the state. He says it wasn't long until farmers started noticing the effects on their cattle.
Dairy farmers were finding their cows were having these horrific effects. They were losing their hair, grotesque hooves grow kind of in a curve. They were having birth defects in their calves. I mean, it was awful, and everybody was talking about it.
Nearly a year passed between the chemical mix-up and its discovery. By then, millions of farm animals across Michigan consumed the fire retardant. Not just cattle, but chickens, pigs, and sheep. PBB didn't just affect animals. Borrello says before affected livestock could be culled, meat and dairy contaminated with PBB were consumed by Michiganders across the state.
Millions of people have PBB in the state of Michigan. I mean, I've got it. My parents had it. My kids will probably have it.
Perhaps not surprisingly, researchers have found troubling health risks in Michiganders who have high levels of PBB, particularly among women. Studies have shown an increased risk of thyroid disease and reproductive health issues. Health effects aren't the only long-term consequences of the Valsicol incident. The chemical company demolished the plant in the late 70s and buried storage tanks and other structures at the site. Nearly 4 years after that, Valsicol buried the toxic soil of a nearby burn pit and seemingly sealed the site off with a concrete cap and slurry wall to protect the adjacent Pine River from contamination. Valsicol's actions were enough to convince the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that the disaster had been appropriately handled. In the end, Valsicol agreed to give nearly $38 million toward cleanup of the site. The EPA cleared the company of nearly all liability. As you can guess, this didn't have a fairy tale ending.
The deal that the EPA struck with Valsicol was shameful. They are actually still operating and still profitable. And the people that made all those decisions to dump those chemicals and put workers in harm's way, those people retired millionaires. There was no retribution.
It was discovered in the 90s that the cap installed by Valsicol was leaking. As a result, literal tons of waste had spilled into the Pine River and contaminated miles of nearby soil. Because of Valsicol's own bankruptcy and the bankruptcy of its parent companies, the site became what is known among environmentalists as orphaned. In other words, there was no longer an owner responsible for its cleanup. The costs associated with the effort instead fell onto the taxpayers. When the ongoing work is finally completed, removing contamination from the site, experts estimate total cleanup costs could reach nearly $500 million. According to Murray Borrello, the effects of the Valsicol incident on St. Louis and the surrounding area aren't just long-lasting. They're permanent.
The groundwater below St. Louis, and we have no idea how far radius around St. Louis, will never be clean. It will never be able to be utilized. The property on top of the site where the chemical plant was, if it is utilized, will be very minimal. Maybe a park. You can't ever build on it forever. I mean, and it even says in the agreement with EPA, in perpetuity, we don't know how to clean these chemicals to the degree where you can reuse it like it was, you know, a natural site.
While Valsicol is one of the worst environmental disasters to impact the country, it's not an isolated incident. Borrello says there are Valsicols largely unnoticed around the country. Bodies of water impacted by no fish advisories or swaths of land blanketed in polluted air. Borrello says it's likely most people won't even notice the pollution in their own backyards, at least not until the health effects of contaminants are fully realized. He says an environmental academic conference hosted at Alma College questioned the effects these contaminants are already having on Americans.
Autism, the rise in autism rates, the rise in certain cancers we've seen around here, blah, blah, blah. You know, how much of this is really due to environmental exposure? And they kind of looked at each other and they said, we believe strongly that we are going to find that a lot of things like autism, autoimmune problems. We have this huge increase in things like Crohn's disease and gastrointestinal issues are going to be related to environmental exposure. Pesticides, air exposure, you know, stuff you don't even know about, we don't even know about. There's just so much contamination in our environment.
Borrello says although it's important to clean up sites impacted by severe pollution, like the former Valsicol site, there isn't much hope for total recovery from disasters. He says the best hope for preserving the environment is not effective recovery. Rather, it's preventing disasters like Valsicol from occurring in the first place. Steve Keen, WCMU.
This is the third and final special on the Third Coast Community Conversations WCMU hosted in Alpena, Petoskey, and Mount Pleasant. And although the topics varied, the common message was we need to keep teaching people how to care for the water. More information on our Third Coast Conversations is at wcmu.org/thirdcoast. There you'll find our special reports and a video of each conversation. That includes our conversation in Alpena, focusing on access and rights to water. From Petoskey, discussing life on the water and how the lake creates a sense of place. And from Mount Pleasant, where the Third Coast Conversation, as you heard, examined recovery and resiliency of waterways. This program was made possible by a grant from Michigan Humanities, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views expressed in this project do not necessarily represent those of Michigan Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to all our conversation participants. The program was produced with assistance from producer Mike Horace, outreach manager Linda Dielman, field operations Sean Hoskey, and web video Chris Ogazali. I'm Amy Robinson. Good night.